Kim talk brightness, Kestled said.
I assure you, good man at arms,
Nickley said, his accent having completely vanished.
There is nothing you can do to me that will get you the answers you desire.
Radiant the Lopan stepped closer. She hadn't shared her entire plan with him, but had given him enough. She knew firsthand the danger of the fused Lightweavers. If Nickley was one of those, she wanted a Radiant ready to face him. At her request, the Lopan scooped Cheery Cheery from her cloth nest on the quarterdeck, then brought her to Rissen. Kestled stood and pulled Nickley to his feet, bound. Rissen held Cheery Cheery up toward him, and the Larkin lethargically chirped. Anything? She asked the Larkin. Cheery Cheery clicked, but didn't otherwise respond. Rissen pulled her back and offered her a sphere, which thankfully she consumed. I don't think he's hiding Stormlight or Voidlight, Rissen said to the soldiers. But I can't be certain. She scratched Cheery Cheery where her carapace met skin. If Nickley was secretly an enemy servant, Cheery Cheery would have drained his light away. At her command, Kestled sent two armsmen to search through Nickley's things. She watched closely, but the captive man showed no sign of Voidbringer powers. He merely drooped in his bonds. Tell me, Nickley, Rissen said. When we search your things, what will we find? Proof that you're the one who poisoned the ship's pet and put the worms in our grain? Nickley refused to meet her eyes. You want me to turn back, Rissen said. Why? And how did you do that trick with the Santhid? When Nickley didn't respond, she looked to the Lopan.
There's no way to tell if he's a fused, Gansha, he explained. At least, no way I can tell. Queen Yasna, sure she could do it. But to Rua and me, he looks like a regular person. Even cutting him won't work. A regular singer, they would bleed blood the wrong color. But a Lightweaver, well, he could change that.
Could we have Cord inspect him? Rissen asked. And see if she spots any strange spren?
Worth a try, the Lopan said, and went to fetch her.
Rissen didn't expect much, unfortunately. Cord had been around this man for the entire trip. If there'd been something to spot, surely she would have noticed it already. Indeed, after a quick inspection, Cord just shrugged. I don't see anything unusual, she said in Vaden. I'm sorry.
We've taken his assistant captive, Brightness, Kestled said softly. Just in case. Plamri knew nothing of this, Nickley muttered. What do we do with him? Kestled said.
Normally she'd have thrown him in the brig. Plamri too, as she wasn't certain she could trust the man. But her ship was approaching a mysterious storm. Traversing that, then exploring the island beyond, would consume her crew's attention. Did she really want a possible Voidbringer sitting in her hold? Unfortunately, if he was a Voidbringer, executing him would do no good. He would simply claim a new body at the next Everstorm. And if he wasn't one, she keenly wanted to interrogate him once the mission was finished. Cord, she said. A moment, please. Rissen pulled herself a little way to the side, and Cord joined her. If he were a servant of one of those gods you told me about, Rissen whispered in Vaden. The ones that guard treasures? Would there be a way to know?
I have no idea, Cord said softly. The gods who sleep not are powerful. Terrible. Cannot die. Cannot be captured. Eternal. Without body. Capable of controlling Kremling and insect.
Delightful. Radiant the Lopan, Rissen called. Would you and Huyo fly our captives to the main island of Amia? Bring some manacles and lock them to whatever convenient feature you find. Give them some food and water. We'll leave them and recover them after exploring Akina.
Sure thing, Gansha, the Lopan said.
It wasn't a perfect solution. She fully expected Nikli to have found a way to escape by the time they returned for him. But at least she'd have him off her ship. Voidbringer, god, or simple traitor, this seemed the best way to protect her crew. She'd send word of his location to the Thalen watchpost. Plamri, at least, might be innocent. She didn't want him left alone if something happened to the Wandersail. One of her sailors arrived with manacles, and Rissen watched, discomforted, as Nikli and Plamri were flown off. Storms! Did she need to suspect every member of her crew of being an enemy lightweaver? The only thing she could do would be to have the captain and Kistled interview every crew member to search for anyone who seemed off. Kistled went to join Captain Durlwan on the quarterdeck. She'd been informed ahead of time, of course. She would make an announcement to the crew. Eventually, the sailors sent to rummage through Nikli's things returned with another bag of poison and, curiously, an annotated recipe book written in Azish. Rissen looked through this, finding notes that said things like, "Humans prefer salt in abundance," or "Cook longer than you think will be required, as they often eat their meals mushy." And most alarmingly, "This will cover the taste," in reference to a spicy dish. The implications haunted her. If his attempts to get them to turn back hadn't been successful, would Nikli have poisoned the crew? It made a terrible kind of sense. They'd have needed another cook if Cord was imprisoned, and Nikli had bragged to her about his cooking ability. She could see a world where he was put in charge of the ship's galley, and the rest of them unwittingly ate his deadly meal. It was time to put some extra precautions in place. A few rats tasting each meal before it was served to the crew, perhaps? "Who are you, really?" she wondered at the distant figure. "And why are you so intent on keeping us away from this island?"
11. The Lopan gained new respect for the Thalen sailors as the ship breached the storm around Akina. He'd spent the last few weeks sitting with them at meals, climbing with them on the rigging, scrubbing the deck alongside them, or swapping stories as they swung in their hammocks at night. He'd even picked up a little Thalen. He was living on a sailing ship, so he figured, sure, the best way to pass the time was to follow Huyo's example and try to become a sailor. Lopan had heard them talk about the terrifying experience of facing down winds and rain while on the sea. "You didn't sail a storm," they'd explained. "You hung on, tried to steer, and hoped to survive until the end." He'd felt the frightened tone in their voices, but damnation, he felt something 10 times worse as the Wandersail headed into the strange storm. He'd flown about in storms, sure. He was a windrunner, but this was different. Something primal inside him cringed as the wind made the water churn and froth, something that trembled as the darkening sky painted the ocean with new ominous shadows, something deep in his heart that said, "Hey, Lopan, this was a bad idea, Mancha." Rua, naturally, took it with a grin on his face, having adopted the shape of a sky eel with human features. He swam through the air around Lopan's head as the ship began to sway like a child's toy in the bath.
"Lopan!" Turlum called, rushing past with a rope. "You may want to get below decks. It's about to get wet up here."
"I won't melt, Regos," Lopan called back.
Turlum laughed and continued on. Good man, Turlum was. Had 6 daughters. 6! Back home in Thalen City. 8 with his mouth open,
but always shared his booze.
At his warning, Lopin took a solid hold on the railing. It was strange to see the ship stripped of most of its sails, like a skeleton without the flesh. But this ship, sure, was special. Fabrial pumps would supposedly keep it bailed no matter how much water washed onto the deck. And there were stabilizers that used attractor fabrials. Those would shift weights around in the hull. Crazy, that stuff was built inside the hull, and keep the ship from capsizing. At the captain's orders, the oars came out. They used those for fine maneuvering when trying to ram enemy ships, but here they could reposition the ship to take big waves the right way. When caught in bad weather, ships would try to run the storm. That meant going with the wind, only in a specific way that sounded extremely technical to Lopin. He'd nodded anyway, since the words had been quite interesting, particularly coming from the lips of mostly drunk men. They couldn't simply run the storm here, though. They had to breach it, reach its core. So they'd follow the storm in a loop around Akina, slowly edging inward, ever inching toward the center. And they had to keep ahead of the waves, which meant sometimes colliding with other ones in front. They'd need to head those waves, keep the ship going straight at them, breaking them across the bow. The oars would help keep them positioned for that. It felt downright heroic to meet these winds with only one small storm sail maintained by a few valiant sailors. The rest were below, either at the oars or maintaining the fabrials. Lopin didn't see how the sail wouldn't just blow them all over the place, but they all said it would work. They'd also tied bags of oil over the side of the ship, too, with punctures to leak, which they said would keep the water from spraying so much on the deck. The captain stood firm and shouted her orders into the wind, sending them straight into the gullet of the beast. And by the hulls themselves, if the sailors didn't take it with determination and grit. The wind picked up further, blowing sprays of water across Lopin's face. Uyo hadn't wanted to come up above, had said Lopin was crazy for insisting on being on deck. And yes, cold water began to seep through his unders to prickle his skin. But storms! It was an incredible view. The lightning made the water seem to spark, transparent, and huge froths of it surged into the air. A storm on land was a sight to behold, sure, but a storm on the waters? This was majestic. Also horrifying.
This is amazing,
Lopin said, pulling himself along the railing so he was closer to Vliksim, the day's helmsman. Three other men stood at the ready to help Vliksim wrestle the wheel to control the rudder. That was common on ordinary ships, but this one had some kind of mechanism to help the helmsman, and so it might not be needed.
You haven't seen anything,
Vliksim shouted. He was bald, like Huyo, which made his eyebrows look extra amusing to Lopin, particularly wet as they were. But he played a mean mouth harp.
We've trained to sail into high storms on this ship if we have to. I've actually been through one. Waves as high as mountains, Lopin.
Ha! Lopin said.
You haven't seen anything. I was once in a place where Everstorm and High Storm met. And in that, the rock flowed like water, and, sure, entire chunks broke like waves against one another. I had to run up one side and slide down the other. Ruined my storm and trousers.
Enough, the captain yelled over the wind. I don't have time for you two to compare sizes. Vliksim, 1 point to port.
The captain eyed Lopin, and he gave her a salute, because they were on her ship, and here she outranked even the people who outranked her. But he got the feeling that the captain was the kind of person who had been born an officer, coming right on out of her mom with a hat on and everything. People like that didn't understand. Bragging wasn't about making yourself look good, but about convincing the other guy you weren't afraid, which was completely different. A wave surged over the deck and Lopin lost his footing but clung on to the ship's aft rail and grinned, sopping wet, at Vliksim when he glanced over.
Lopin righted himself with effort and thought about Vlixim's words. How could waves get bigger than these? They sailed up the side of one that Lopin could have sworn was too steep to ride. Then they went crashing through the top, like Punyo through a crowd on his way to the privy after a night of drinking. Lopin whooped as they teetered, then came rushing down the wave's other side. Rua swirled about him as a ribbon of light, excited, dancing with the wave spren, who went splashing high into the air as different waves met. This was the best time they'd had in ages. Then Turlum, the fellow who had passed Lopin with the rope earlier, got caught in an unexpected wave and washed clean off the deck, into the drink, the dark abyss, to be claimed by the seas and strangled with water. Well, couldn't have that. Lopin burst alight and leaped over the rail, lashing himself toward the water. He hit with his own crash, pulling in so much stormlight he glowed brightly in the dark water, revealing a struggling figure being swept away in the currents. Well, Lopin had spent a few days practicing this while out on the ocean doing scouting runs. Lashings worked fine underwater, and hey, who needed to breathe when you had stormlight? He lashed himself toward the dark figure, Rua guiding the way, and blasted through the ocean like some kind of underwater creature built to move through it easily and swiftly. Or, well, like a fish. They called those fish, didn't they? Lopin grabbed hold of the struggling form by his clothing, then lashed both of them upward. Rua pointed the way. It could be surprisingly difficult to tell directions in the darkness underwater. Lopin exploded from the ocean a moment later, carrying a sputtering Turlum. Rua darted ahead, leading him toward the ship, which was good because in the dark tempest, details were about as easy for Lopin to make out as his own backside. Lopin hauled Turlum over the rail and hit the deck with a thump, then lashed the man in place so he wouldn't go sliding off again.
"Storms," Fimkin said, stumbling over to help the other sailor.
Fimkin had a medic background, and he and Lopin had bonded over the fact that both had been told too many storming times to boil bandages.
"How did you... Lopin? You saved him!"
"It's kind of our thing," Lopin said.
Turlum sputtered, then started laughing uncontrollably. Joy spren, like little blue leaves, spun around him, then swirled into the air. He gripped Lopin's hand in thanks. The old one. His bridge forehand, not his night radiant hand. Fimkin sent Turlum below decks. A replacement had already come up to take his post, so Lopin unlashed him. Storms, that replacement had shown up quickly. They were expecting to lose people. Or at least they were prepared for it.
Well, not on Lopin's watch. You didn't let your friends drown in nameless oceans during a frigid storm. That was sure basic friendship rules right there.
He marched back up onto the quarterdeck. The captain and the others here had ropes to hold them in place, but those had to be short and didn't generally work for the other sailors, who needed a lot of freedom of movement. A long rope on a man who got swept overboard in this kind of storm broke necks and smashed sailors into the hull. The chances were better, though still slim, without ropes. Lopin figured he should be extra careful with the captain anyway. With her permission, he stuck one of her feet to the deck, so she could move a little, but had one really steady foot to rely on.
"You could have done that all along?"
the captain asked.
"I saw you struggling to keep upright earlier. You were sliding about with the waves. Why didn't you stick yourself down?"
"Didn't seem sporting,"
Lopin called over the increasingly loud sounds of the storm.
"You keep us going straight, Captain. I'll watch the crew."
She nodded and turned to her task, running with the winds, but, best they could, on their own terms. He had to trust she was keeping the ship on its spiral heading, moving steadily inward, because he couldn't make any sense of this. The sea seemed to be damnation itself, incarnate as furious waves. Lopin kept an eye on the sailors, but he had Rua watching something else. Eventually, after splashing through wave after wave, the little honor spren came zipping up to Lopin in the shape of a sky eel with an extremely long tail.
"What is it, Nocco?"
Lopin asked. Rua pointed at the water nearby, and Lopin saw a shape in the depths, or at least a dark shadow. Size was difficult to judge because he didn't know how deep the thing was, but Rua was insistent. It was one of them, the things that had feasted on stormlight, draining the windrunners who had tried to investigate the storm before.
"It's swimming?"
Lopin asked, wiping rainwater from his eyes.
"How can you be certain that's one of them, Nako?"
Rua simply was, and Lopin trusted him.
He figured, sure, Rua would know about this sort of thing, same as Lopin knew about one-armed Tardassian jokes.
Layton and the others hadn't been able to report much about the things.
They thought they were alive, not Spren, but couldn't be certain.
The things had needed to get close to them, though, so it probably couldn't affect Lopin up here on the deck. Layton said they'd hovered out in the clouds, indistinct, until he turned. Then they'd come in from behind and drained him. But were they the same type of creature as what Rissen kept as a pet? This one in the water seemed far larger. And more blobby, somehow. Lopin would need to be careful when rescuing other members of the crew. If that thing drained him while he was in the drink, it would be catastrophic. He'd have to learn some dead Tardassian jokes to tell in the afterlife. The sailing continued a long, terrible time. Lopin kept a vigilant watch through it all, and so was ready when Wivlon lost his footing. Lopin was on him before he was swept overboard and pulled them both up against the rail and stuck them there, water cascading over them. He gave Wivlon a pat and a laugh, but when Lopin got to his knees to let the water stream off him, he noticed the dark shadow in the water right over the side of the ship, keeping pace with them. He wished he could get Cord out here to see if any strange Spren were nearby, but he didn't dare bring her into this storm. It would be... The ship crashed through one final wave, and the wind abruptly stopped. Amazed, Lopin stumbled to his feet, then wiped his eyes again. Nearby, sailors relaxed, loosening their grips on the ropes they'd been using to do, well, some sailor things with the storm sail.
"We made it," Clisson said. "Storms, it's like the center beat."
An Ospren burst around him, and Lopin agreed with the sentiment. The rough waves and wind blew in a circular pattern right behind them. Dark clouds still blocked the sky, but the ship cut through choppy, smaller waves, settling into a peaceful rest here, where even the waters seemed less dark, more sapphire than they had on the way in.
"Hey, Clisson," Lopin said. "Would you go fetch Cord for me? I told her I'd get her as soon as it was safe, but I should go unstick your captain from the deck. I suspect she is liking it about as much as Punyo did during the weeks I had a Spren and he did not."
"Sure thing, Lopin,"
Clisson said, running off. He was a great fellow. Skilled partner at cards, plus he had an excellent sense of humor. And not only because he thought Lopin's jokes were funny, he also thought Huyo's were terrible. Lopin hastened up the stairs to the quarterdeck, then slowed as he stepped up beside the captain and helmsman. They were staring out across the ocean towards something emerging from distant fog. An island. It was surrounded by big stone spikes rising out of the ocean like a wall somehow built in the sea itself. But there was a huge gap where a dozen or more had either been removed or never placed. As the ship drifted farther, the waters stilled in an eerie way. The gap revealed a shallow island, small enough that Lopin could probably walk around the perimeter in an hour or so. Near the center, he spotted what he thought must be city walls, and maybe some structures near them.
"Well, hie me off to damnation," the captain muttered. "It's actually real."
12. "We're here, Chiri Chiri," Rissen whispered, as several of the sailors set her into her chair on the quarterdeck. "Look, I've brought you home." Chiri Chiri nestled into her arms and barely moved. Rissen held her close as the captain and her brother conversed quietly nearby. "Storms. The island looked so surreal, with that too-still ocean the distant fog, that strange rock palisade in the waters around it. The island itself was low and flat, except for that part near the center. Were those walls or a natural plateau? The crew had gathered on deck, mingled with anticipation, Spren, like red streamers waving in an unfelt wind. Rissen wasn't close enough to hear what they whispered to one another, and she almost tried to pull herself along the rail to get closer. Only a few days with her hovering chair, and already she relied on it. Well, if this place turned out to be an enemy stronghold, they might have to leave quickly. She didn't want to risk the floating chair, so she'd ordered it stowed and had the gemstones in her pocket. Her quarterdeck seat would have to do. So she sat quietly, trying not to feel overwhelmed. They were here, finally. Rissen had brought them here. How would Vestim have proceeded? She didn't know. She had learned his wisdom, but now she simply had to trust her own instincts. That was more frightening to her than it had ever been before. "Captain," she said, calling toward Durlwan. "What do you think? What news from the eel's nest?" The woman strode over. "I have three men with spyglasses searching for anything suspicious," the captain said. "No signs of life, though there are definitely structures farther in. Not much wind here, oddly, but we can use oars to maneuver. These waters look treacherous, so we'll want to go slowly. The depths around Aemia often have hidden hazards beneath the surface. Assuming all goes well, we could maneuver through that gap and get in close to the island." She hesitated. "Rebsk, the lookouts report what appear to be gem hearts on the beach. Just lying there, discarded among the shells of fallen beasts." "Curious." Rissen took a deep breath. "I authorize a slow approach. Warn me if anything new is spotted, and kindly have someone ask the Radiance and their party to come speak with me." She could see Lopan, Huyo, and Rushu chatting softly with Cord down on the main deck. The captain ordered some of the sailors to man the oars, and soon they were gliding carefully toward the ring of tall rocks that surrounded the island. They reminded her of the obelisks the Deshi nomads set up at their various way stops. Eerily, the only sounds were those of the oars on the water, a stark counterpoint to the raging winds and waters they'd left behind. As they moved, checking depth on both sides of the ship every minute or two, the Radiance and their friends stepped up onto the quarterdeck. "What do you see, Cord?" Rissen asked in Vaden. "Lux Spren," she said, pointing overhead. "But they're not approaching the island. There are dozens upon dozens flying around out here. Lopan showed me a shadow of something under the water that he thinks might be what drained Stormlight from the other Radiance. But I saw no Spren. The shadow vanished quickly, but I think he must be Toa, not Leaky. I think you say physical and not mind? Of the mind world?" "Curious," Rissen replied, though she wasn't entirely certain she understood. "Hi," Lopan said. "You speak, is that?" "Vaden," Rissen said in Alethi. "I do." "I might be able to get the ship through that gap," the captain said, walking over. "How would you like to proceed, Rebsk?"
"Take us as close as you dare, Captain," Rissen said.
Durlwan skillfully guided them up to the gap, and after another check of depths, sailed the ship right through the opening. The captain brought them in close enough to the island that Rissen could make out bleached carapace on the shore, the remnants of ancient great shells. Again she held up Cheery Cheery, hoping to get some reaction. Talik had said they should come here.
But what now? Chiri-Chiri didn't seem interested in the place, though she did look up toward the sky and then stirred, chirping softly. Rissen placed Chiri-Chiri carefully in her lap, and the creature didn't move much, but did keep her attention on the sky. Could she sense those invisible spren, perhaps? Kostled stepped up and handed Rissen a spyglass. Through it, she easily made out the carapace husks, as well as large diamond gem hearts lying scattered around. Done, showing no light, they lay as if they'd fallen right where the beasts had died. Something about that struck her as odd.
Orders, Rebsk? The captain asked her.
Orders. It was time to be in charge. She ignored her fluttering heart, her worry for Chiri-Chiri.
Radiant the Lopan and Ardent Rushu, I assume you two will want to be on with your secret mission?
The two shared a glance, and were embarrassed enough to draw a few shame spren, like floating flower petals.
Yes, Brightness, Rushu said. We'll want to strike inward, toward those buildings. I suggest letting my men do a quick reconnaissance before you do so, Rissen said. Kostled, take a large contingent of sailors and, leaving non-combatants on the ship for now, secure the beach. Report anything unusual.
He bowed to her, then went to gather the sailors. As the rowboats were lowered, Lopan and Huyo climbed aboard. So did Rushu.
Ardent Rushu? Rissen called after her. I suggest you wait until we're certain the beach is safe.
A fine suggestion, Rushu called back. But don't worry about me, Brightness.
And she settled herself on the bench of one of the boats.
Well,
she wasn't technically under Rissen's authority, so she could do as she wished. Cord wisely didn't insist on going. Instead, she knelt beside Rissen's chair, then turned her gaze from Chiri-Chiri up toward the sky. Was there a connection between the Luxpren and Chiri-Chiri? Sky eels were the only other creature her size that could fly, and they were often accompanied by Luxpren. Chiri-Chiri chirped again, an encouraging sign. Rissen gave her a sphere to eat, then glanced over her shoulder toward the storm. The fog obscured much of that, but in clearer patches she could see a sweeping barrier of wind and tempest, like the storm wall of a high storm, only blowing circularly.
We should finish this as quickly as possible, Rissen said to Durlwan, who still stood nearby. Once we're certain the shore is safe, have some of the sailors begin scouting around the perimeter of the island. We can collect any interesting artifacts and give the Radiance time to...
Chiri-Chiri thrashed in her lap. Rissen looked down as the creature perked up for the first time in weeks, then stood, her wings fluttering. She was still staring at the sky.
Cord, Rissen said in Vaden. Is she seeing Luxpren?
I think so, Cord said. They've begun to fly lower.
Rissen squinted and believed she could see them, faint arrowhead figures shimmering in the air. Chiri-Chiri chirped louder. Rissen found her heart beating faster, her breaths quickening. She'd begun to worry that this had somehow all been in vain, that there would be nothing here to help Chiri-Chiri. The Larkin zipped into the air.
Storms! It had been forever since she'd flown so energetically.
The Luxpren began moving more quickly. Rissen lost sight of them, and Cord gasped. Chiri-Chiri immediately tucked and dove straight down into the water. Rissen cried out, her excitement bleeding into panic. She twisted and leaned over the side, joined by Cord. Chiri-Chiri swiftly vanished into the shadows, moving beneath some rocks and out of sight.
She followed the spren, Cord whispered. Something is happening. Something is odd.
She narrowed her eyes. The captain stepped to the rail.
Did you know it could swim?
Rissen shook her head, feeling an alarming spike of loss. What if Chiri Chiri never came back? What if by bringing her here, Rissen had unwittingly offered her freedom and she'd taken it? Well, Rissen tried to be positive. That was better than Chiri Chiri being sick. And if the creature wanted freedom, Rissen wouldn't confine her. At the same time, so much emotion was wrapped up in her experiences with the Larkin. Rissen's slow recovery from her accident, her year of melancholy, her near death at the hands of Voidbringers. Chiri Chiri had been with her for all that, and, in that brief first moment wondering if she was alone, Rissen found a startling fragility to her feelings, a desire to cling to something she loved and never, never let go. Was that selfish? A trade or exchange couldn't be a good one unless both parties gained something from it. Yet not everything was about exchanges and trades. It was sometimes difficult for her to remember that.
Rebsk, the captain asked.
I will wait here to see if she returns, Captain,
Rissen said, trying to remain steady.
Please, bring me word from the shore party as soon as they've inspected the beach.
13. Lopin stood dramatically at the prow of the small boat, one foot up, spear over his shoulder, Rua standing in exactly the same pose on his other shoulder. The sailors had unshipped their oars behind him as the rowboat now moved along under its own power. Why make the sailors work when you had lashings? Besides, Lopin could see a shadow under the water moving along with him. These waters were shallow now, but whatever it was stayed close to the bottom, and with the clouds in the sky it was dark enough down there to prevent Lopin from making out what it was. He was still convinced, however, that this shadow was the thing that could feed off Stormlight, but not a little one like Chiri Chiri. This was bigger, and a different shape. Flatter? It was hard to tell. He'd hoped it would surface and try to steal the Stormlight he put into the rowboat. It didn't. It seemed timid, frightened of him, unwilling to confront him directly. So Lopin tried to keep an eye on it and had Rua do the same. It was hard, considering how exciting this next part was going to be. Ahead, the water gave way to a rocky beach, which was overgrown with storming gem hearts like they were rock buds. The chitinous remains of great shells watched over them with hollow, cavernous eyes, discarded armor of beasts long dead. Huyo's boat drifted up beside Lopin's, then slowed to match his lazy speed as they crossed the bay. Lopin's cousin crouched, holding his spear in a tense posture.
"Can you believe it, older cousin?" Lopin said. "Stepping foot on a land no person has ever visited?"
"There was a city here, Lopin," Huyo said. "It was literally one of the capitals of the Epic Kingdoms."
"Well, yeah," Lopin said. "But sure, there's got to be a portion of it nobody ever stepped on, right?"
"I wouldn't bet on that," he said, "considering how long the Epic Kingdom stood and the expected population numbers."
"Fine," Lopin said, pointing forward heroically, with Rua copying him. "Onward we go, to step foot on a land no person has visited in centuries."
"Except the crew of that other ship," Huyo said, "who probably landed on the island, since they weren't found on their ship, and others who presumably killed those people. We'll be the first, except for all those."
Lopin sighed and glanced at Rua, who rolled his head from one shoulder to another in annoyance, then made it fall off.
"Cousin," Lopin said, "do you know why it is that people stick you to the wall so often?"
"To judge the relative strength of radiance by oath level, measuring the duration of lashings against the Stormlight expended."
"It's because you're no fun."
"Nah,
I decided to let it be fun. You get an entirely new perspective on life when hanging from the wall.
Huyo grinned, then both of them turned sharply. The shadow under the ocean had changed direction, slipping away back toward deeper waters. Apparently it didn't want to rise up high enough to let them get a good look at it. Lopin's lashing ran out right as the boat ground against the stones and beached itself. As it jerked to a halt, he used the momentum to tip forward and step straight onto the shore. Now that was style. He glanced around to see if anyone had noticed. Too bad Cord was on the ship, waiting until the sailors had scouted the region. Sailors jumped out of the other large rowboats, then had to wade through the water to pull them ashore. Rua watched that with sadness.
"You could go run through the water if you want, Nako," Lopin said.
Rua glanced at him, still sitting on Lopin's shoulder in his small form, then cocked his head.
"Well, yes," Lopin said.
He always knew what Rua meant. It was the way things were.
"Just because I have style, landing with elegant dignity and control, doesn't mean those fellows lack style when running through the waves. They have sailor style. Well, I've got the Lopin style."
He tapped Rua on the nose.
"Don't let people tell you that style is limited, pretending it will run out like stormlight. Style is the best resource in the world, because we can make as much of it as we want. And there's plenty, sure, for everybody."
He put his hands on his hips and studied the beach, then ran over to help Rushu get out of her boat, because ardent style, with all those pieces of paper, did not involve getting wet.
"Thank you, Radiant Lopin,"
she said as she tucked her notebook under her arm. A sailor who climbed out after her carried her span reed and other equipment.
"So, what do we make of this?"
"There's money," Lopin
said, waving toward the diamond gem hearts with his spear.
"Lying on the stormin' ground."
"Yes, curious," Rushu said.
"Dead place," Huyo said. "Place of dead."
He cursed softly in Herdazian, trying to find the right Alethi words.
"Oh," Rushu said. "I'll bet this is a place where great shells come to die. I've read of that sort of thing. I'll have to write to Brightness Shallan. She studies great shell life cycles."
Kisled walked up, his back straight as the ship's mast, a barbed spear over his shoulder and a short sword at his waist.
"I suppose," he said, gesturing to the riches, "these are cursed, and I should forbid my men from indulging."
"Don't be silly,"
Rushu said, writing something in her notebook.
"We're here to loot the place, Armsman Kistled. Have the men heave-ho or whatever and get on with it. I want to sleep in a bed of boundless lucre tonight."
"Aren't you an ardent?"
Kistled asked.
"And therefore forbidden personal possessions?"
"Doesn't mean a lady can't lie in a big heap of gemstones," Rushu said. "They talk about it in the stories. I've always wondered how uncomfortable it would be."
She looked up from her notebook, wide-eyed, as she regarded them all.
"What? I'm serious. Go, gather it all up. We were sent to collect artifacts from this place, and those gemstones absolutely count. Though perhaps remind the sailors that they'll get their traditional percentage share from this salvage, so they'll all be rich when we return, assuming they don't try to hide anything or steal from the others."
"Assign me several of your best, Kistled," Lopin said. "Once Brightness Rissen approves, I'll take them and the Ardent and scout inward. See what we find off the beach."
Well, see if they could locate the Oath Gate. But he wasn't supposed to talk about that part. Rushu said the Queen wanted it quiet, though Rissen apparently knew about it. Everyone was pretty worried about the presence of an Oath Gate out here, where who knows what could access it. They could keep the site at Urethiru locked, of course, so it wasn't an immediate danger, but still. Lopin wasn't exactly certain what they were supposed to do about the thing if they did find it. He didn't have a living blade, and neither did Huyo. He'd suggested that Kaladin send Teft along, and the answer had surprised him. I suggested that to Navani as well, Kaladin had said, and she replied that if this Oathgate was in the hands of enemies, she didn't fancy sending them a key. Your job is to see if it's there, scout for an enemy presence, then return. We'll decide if occupying the place is worth the difficulty after we know for certain whether the Oathgate is there. He stepped over to Rushu, who was doing some quick sketches of how the exoskeletons were laid out and how the gem hearts had fallen. The region felt so empty, quiet as a home with no cousins. But after flying up a little, he could see that Huyo was right. There had once been a small city at the center. It took Lopin a while to realize something else felt eerie about the place, as if that carapace and all this unnatural silence weren't enough. No Krem. Everywhere else he'd been, you could tell old things by the Krem buildup. Over time, buildings became lumps in the landscape. Not here. Nothing on the beach, the carapaces, those gem hearts, had a crust on it. No dust, either. The place was, sure, cleaner than a soldier's bunk on inspection day. He lowered down and picked up a small diamond gem heart. Like the others, it wasn't glowing. He should have realized what that meant. High storm water doesn't fall here, he thought, scanning the dark clouds. Maybe the strange winds blow high storms away. He tucked the gem heart in his pocket and strolled over to Rushu, then peeked over her shoulder, to her annoyance, which was fun, at the pictures she'd drawn. They were storming good, considering how quickly she'd done them. I once ate 12 charter wraps in under 2 hours, he said to her. It was sure kind of the same thing. She gave him a baffled look. Maybe she didn't like charter. Punyu bet me 3 clear chips I couldn't do it, he explained. So it was a matter of knightly honor. Rushu gave him a suffering glance, then rolled and tied a little string around her drawings. She handed them to a sailor. Take these to Brightness Rissen and tell her the beach is safe, so we'd like to continue up toward the city. The sailor ran off and rowed with a few others to the ship. A green flag was soon raised from the mast, giving permission to continue, so Lopin gathered the assigned sailors and joined Rushu in hiking farther inland. Huyo decided to remain with the sailors on the beach, but he had a span read. Couldn't write with it, of course, but Huyo liked to use one anyway. When you turned on the span read, it would make the one paired to it blink. So some Alethi officers used that to indicate a response to a message, like a raised flag. Well, Huyo took it further. Crazy Chorlano. He figured he could make them blink a certain number of times to mean different things. In this case, once you noticed and acknowledged him, he had a code. 1 blink meant all is well, 2 meant I'm worried, 3 meant come back immediately. It was kind of like writing, but it was all right, because it was numbers, and nobody thought numbers were unseemly for a man to use. Lopin, sure, used numbers for lots of things. He'd even made up a few. Plus, Dalinar could write books, which meant everything was different now. Lopin kept an eye on those clouds above as he walked proudly forward with Rua on his shoulder. Yes, maybe people had been here before, but that was mostly a long time ago, so... You think, he said to Rushu, we could say I'm stepping foot on ground where no Herdazian has walked before?
Undoubtedly, she said. Herdaz didn't exist when Aemia was a kingdom. Yours is a relatively new country, after all. I presume there are lots of places a person of Herdazian nationality hadn't stepped before you and the others arrived here. All of Urethiru, for example.
Ha!
Lopin said, spinning his spear. Stupid Huyo!
Come on, Nako! Let's go make history!
14. Rissen sat on the quiet deck of her ship, alone, save for the captain and a small crew. A sailor kept watch for trouble from the eel's nest, ready to call a warning if something dangerous approached the shore team. Rissen studied the sketches Rushu had sent,
heaps of carapace, the remnants of enormous great shells who had died, and the gem hearts they grew. Untold riches. It was too perfect. Rissin looked up as she heard footsteps coming onto the quarterdeck. Cord? I thought you were going ashore with the dinghy. Now that we know it's safe, Rissin said. I should go, Cord agreed. But, she looked down over the side of the ship. They're all below, in the water, Rissin. All of the Lux Spren. Well, Rissin said. You could go help gather gemstones. There's heaps of treasure on that beach. Everyone who came on this mission is going to return home rich. Cord frowned. Yes, but he is the wrong treasure. You notice it too? Rissin said. Notice what? There's something wrong about how this looks, Rissin said, gesturing to the sketch. No, Cord said. Just, I wanted other treasure. Shard blades and armor, like the Alethi have. Cord leaned on the railing, looking out at the beach. My people are proud, Rissin. But we're also weak. Very weak. Not weak individually, but weak as a nation. We spent years and years trying to get shards. This thing cost us many of our bravest fighters. And so far, the only shards we have belong to my father, who insists he cannot use them. She shook her head. The Alethi have shards. The Thalans have shards. The Vedans have shards. But on the peaks, we have none. You don't need shards, Cord. Rissin said. You live on mountains far from everyone else. They can't get to you, and they don't want to. Well, yes, Rissin said. It's nothing against you and your people, but I've made a life out of traveling to difficult places to trade, and even my Babsk said that trying to trade with the Horn Eaters was akin to the seventh fool. I'm sure you have many things of great value, and your people seem wonderful, but the trip is so arduous that trade is almost impossible. Cord didn't seem insulted. She simply nodded. That's how this thing has been, for many years. Nothing worth the trip, nothing that people knew about. What do you mean? The Alethi know now, she said. And the enemy always knew. The peaks have a portal, Rissin. A gateway. A path to the world of gods and Spren. She met Rissin's eyes. Soon, everyone will know. And they will want our land. A portal to the land of Spren is valuable enough to be worth the trip to the peaks. Rissin trailed off. She wasn't certain what to make of this. A portal to the land of the Spren? She'd heard about Shadesmar. Rumors of it were making their way through society. But if the Horn Eaters had a way into the place... You are allies with the Alethi and the rest of us, Rissin said. We can protect you. Pardon, Cord said. I have Alethi friends. The Alethi Queen seems worthy. But they know that strong countries take from weak ones. They will say this thing is for everyone's good. They will say they're protecting us. But they will move to where we are. They will live in our cities, for everyone's good. She nodded. So we must have shards, and many shard bearers, and radiants, many radiants. My father could be both, but he thinks tradition is more important than our people. I will do this thing instead. I will find treasures. We must be strong. So strong. Rissin immediately felt guilty. When Cord had said she wanted treasure earlier, Well, Rissen had assumed Cord had a simplistic, common motivation. People talked about wealth and how greed was such a terrible thing, and it could be dangerous, true. Yet the ambition of someone who had nothing to rise to a new station should not be easily dismissed or thought simplistic. There was so much more to it. So why not join the expedition going to the center of the city? Rissen asked. There might be shards there. If there are, Cord said, the Radiants will claim them. I need to go a different direction. And the Spren? She shook her head, then turned to Rissen. Thank you, by the way. For what? For not assuming I was bad, Cord said. That man, Nikli, he tried to, what is the word in Vaden, make others think I was evil? He framed you. Framed. Like a picture. Same word, different meaning. Ah. Why, with so many sounds, do lowlanders make words that sound the same but mean different things? Anyway, thank you for not believing I was evil. I think many people, they dislike foreign people like me, always believe them to be evil. But you believed me instead of your friend. I've been taught by a very wise man to see the world differently, Rissen said. You can thank him when I introduce you. Thinking of Vestim, however, made her realize what was bothering her about the pictures of the shore. She pointed at the sketch of the many gem hearts. There was a time once, Rissen said, when I went with my Babsk, the man who trained me, to trade, and the person we met had left spheres and gemstones all about, casually, a sign of wealth. My Babsk, he traded differently with this person than others we'd met. Harsher, more cutthroat. That means, well, it's another word for harsher, I guess. Cord took one of the sketches. This thing is the same? Maybe, Rissen said. Afterward, I asked my Babsk why he'd acted that way. He told me, people don't leave money out casually. They do it to make you see it. Either they want to pretend they have more than they have, or... Or? Cord asked. Or they want you to fixate on it, Rissen said, and ignore some greater prize. Would you fetch one of the sailors for me? I need to deliver a message to Rushu.
15. Lopin soared up high, Rua at his side, surveying the island. From up here, it seemed so small. The city had a curious shape, like a flower with radiating petals. The rest of the island was boring. One big, long beach. Nothing moved, nothing seemed suspicious, which he figured was how a place that was suspicious would act. He dropped down to the rest of the group, where Rushu was doing a sketch of some of the buildings here at the outskirts of the city. These were covered in creme, giving them that familiar, melted appearance that he associated with old things.
From up there, he said, it all just looks like rocks. Why do you suppose there's creme here but not on the beach?
I would guess, she said, still sketching, that some of this was already covered in creme when the high storms stopped reaching this island. The carapace and gem hearts by the beach are certainly old, but they must be fresher than these ruins.
What he'd mistaken for walls when first approaching was really a line of buildings. Homes, perhaps? They were uniform, and groups of them formed the tips of the flower petals he'd seen from above. Rushu finished her sketch, then turned to another page in her notebook, one that contained some kind of map.
Hey, Lopin said, that looks exactly like the city.
An ancient map of Akina, she explained. I was hoping to use it to conclusively prove this is the same place. You seem to have done that for me.
Glad to help,
Lopin said. With their squad of 8 spear-wielding sailors, they moved inward, passing the grown-over buildings and entering the heart of the city. Here, the roofs had all fallen in, leaving pillars and some remnants of walls. It was covered in just enough creme to make the ruins feel like they were sinking into the ground, but not enough to turn them into lumps. The result gave the place an almost rotting cast, reminding him of the refuse he'd find in the chasms with Bridge 4. These were the bones, the broken branches, and the withered flesh of a once grand city.
"It's smaller than I'd imagined," Lopin said, turning about and using his spear to gesture toward the far end of the city. "I could walk across the whole place in sure less time than it takes Punya to do his hair before we go out dancing."
"Older cities were all that way,"